Good evening. Okay, we just made a beginning of Shmuel Aleph. I just appreciate the fact people came out. It's kind of a cold evening, which I think I seem to remember the first year we did on Shoftim around that time was also very cold. So we're trying to get warmed up at a very cold time. Saying that, there's a lot to get warmed up about. This first chapter of Sefer Shmuel, everybody knows it. We know about Chana, we know about Shmuel, and the fact that she offered him to go and work in the temple. You know, everyone learned this in Hebrew school. What I'm going to try and do is actually show you what really happened. Because the reality is, it's not quite the way it seems. Even Chana's promise to take Shmuel to the base of Mikdash, just to throw a spanner in the works. Is that what you say here? Monkey wrench. Right? In English we call it a spanner. I know the same thing. Just to make it complicated, the reason why it's so complicated is that Shmuel's a Levi. If Shmuel's a Levi, he's going to work in the base of Mikdash anyway. He's going to work in the temple, because Levim worked in the temple. So what is she doing to offer to make him part of the temple entourage? You know, he's going to be there anyway, because he's a Levi. So what's the whole promise? You're promising to do something which is going to happen anyway, right? Or you can argue she's promising to bring him young, but he's going to go there. He's going to be there. There's a lot to say about her neder, which we will get to, either start getting to today, or hopefully Mirat Hashem next week. But in the meantime, we've got to deal with Chana and Penina. I refer you to chapter 1, and we're looking at Pasuk Vav. And if you haven't read this last week, and I'm just going to read it again. And this is a very, very difficult item to really go into. Because there's a lot of traditions about it, and it's incredibly difficult. And we already touched on this last week. I mentioned the problem. Hopefully we're going to try and solve the problem. It's not the problem is well known. The solution is not so well known, not so easy to get to. Pasuk Vav, verse 6, V'ki asatat tzarata gam kas, b'avor harima. Basically what happened was Elkanah was married to two wives. We learned about Elkanah last week, and he's this incredible get-up-and-go sort of person. He doesn't sit around. He wants to go to the Mishkan. He goes four times a year instead of three times a year. Gets the whole of Klal Yisrael excited about going back to the Mishkan. He's an incredible guy. And in the meantime, at home, he's got a bit of tzaras, right, behind closed doors. And the tzaras is pretty bad. He's got two wives, one who's constantly having children. The other one has been davening for a very long time, according to Chazal, 19 years. She's praying for a child, and it's not happening. And the way the relationship between the two wives is this wonderful word that they use for a co-wife, tsaras, right? And the Gemara talks about it in Yevamos, tsaras, all right? Because having two wives is inevitably going to be some sort of collision course somewhere along the line. And it's going to create, I think Chazal knew what they were saying, tsaras, literally. And this is the story. Ki asatat tsarata gamkas. Now the co-wife, Penina, causes vexation to Chana, anger, literally, b'avor harima, to make her complain, right? In other words, to get her upset, okay? Ki sagah Hashem bad rachma, because God has closed her womb. Basically, she saw Chana trying to daven and to ask God for a child, and what Penina is doing is adding, as you say in England, do you say this expression here, insult to injury, yeah, that's all right. Some of these expressions translate, some of them don't. Whether you say it's not my cup of tea in this country, not my cup of coffee, I've never actually worked that one out. I tried it in Ivrit, Zelo Koste Shali, and the Israelis just looked at me blankly, wondering what I was talking about. But it doesn't work in Hebrew, I can tell you that now. All right, Pasuk Zayin, V'chein Yaseh Shana B'Shana. This went on year after year. Oy vey, midei alotah b'beit Hashem, as they were going up to the house of Hashem, Kain tachisena, she continued to vex her. Penina was taunting her the whole time. But tivkev alotachah, she got to the point where she just didn't eat. All right, she got so upset, Chana, that she couldn't even eat. And we know that, this is a reaction that we can relate to. We understand this tremendous despair, the sense of depression. I mean, she must have been really depressed. Vayom ala el kanaisha. And Elkanah chips in over here, and was mentioned last week. He mentioned it. Chana, lama tivki. So, here comes the guy who's going to solve the problem. When men put their foot, it's usually in their mouths, and this is exactly what he does. He says, Chana, lama tivki. Why are you crying, Chana? The lama lo tochli. Why don't you eat something? Es mankin, or in this case, man vibe. Lama yeralevavich. Why is your heart so bad? Why are you feeling so terrible? Halon nochi tov lach me'asar banim. About the worst thing he could have said. I'm better than 10 sons. Oi, does he really remotely understand what this woman is going through? All right, and this is a very serious question. A lot of people try to placate Elkanah in this situation. I just want to make this point. And I couldn't print this out. I had this in hand. I didn't take this to work, so I wasn't sort of printed it. But I'll just read to you the sort of things he said to her, just to give you some idea of what this man, who is so incredible when it comes to the community, but it seems to be almost to the point of not insensitivity, it's more than that. It's just total lack of understanding. And I'll just read it to you, and I apologize you don't have it in front of you, but just bear with me. Basically, this is taken from Yeshua Bachrach. He's written a volume. A volume was brought out of his thoughts on the first chapter of Shmuel. It's frustrating because they've got a volume on the first chapter, then all the rest of his stuff is on chapter 15 and 16 beyond. So from chapter 1 to chapter 15, we don't seem to have anything of his writing. And I know he taught it because I was in his shir. I heard him teach this stuff. But nobody seems to have written it down. It's kind of frustrating for me. I don't know. Somebody one day hopefully will bring this out. Wonderful teacher. Yeshua Bachrach was amazing, unbelievable individual in Israel, taught in Michlala, taught in a whole bunch of schools, and also in the Kolo I was studying, he was one of the teachers there. I'll just read you very quickly what Rashi says. Halo anochi tov lach, mechavavech, anochi yoter me'asar banim. He says, I should be more beloved to you than 10 children. Sheyoldali Penina. Why does he mention 10 children? The reference is to Penina, who had 10 children. All right, why does he say, I am better for you than 10 children? Because Penina had 10 children. So that in itself is kind of insensitive. You know, your co-wife who has the 10 children, I should be better than the 10 children which Penina has. And of course, not realizing by mentioning that Penina has 10 children, that just gets kind of more riled up. Her tears are even, you know, it's another box of tissues. And he says, "Va'avosi tova hilach." The tzaddik says, "My love is stronger for you. Me'ilu yalada asar b'nei, more than if you'd had 10 children," which is so not understanding the pain that she's in. And it goes even more than this. Listen to this. This is taken from midrashic sources. Lama tivki. He said to her, "Why are you crying?" Omar lo. He said to Sarah, "Shaita akara. Sarah was barren." She sat and cried the whole day. So why are you crying? As if he knew what Sarah was doing all day. All right? Apart from anything else, by the time she got to the age of 90, one assumes that Sarah was beyond that stage, right? And the fact when she's told she's having a child, she just bursts out into laughter. She can't believe it. All right? However you understand Yitzchak and Yitzchak, right? We're talking about that. Why don't you eat? And what's the reference here? Ella Rivka. He says, what about Rivka? She was also barren. Would she sit there and not eat something? You know, this is unbelievable insensitivity. And it goes on. And of course, you'll notice that Chana doesn't say anything. Because the next pasuk says, V'atakam Chana achrei achla b'shilo v'achrei shato v'eliyakun yeshev ha'kisa v'zuzah hechal Hashem. Basically, what happened was that Chana did agree to eat something. Otherwise, you know, she probably was in a terrible situation. But at that point, but she doesn't say anything. So what's her reaction? And the Barbanel says, "Lo zachakatul tshuvat Chana." The response of Chana is not mentioned. Ki lo yelada pe lashiv. She had nothing. She couldn't say anything. She was dumbstruck. She was so overwhelmed by her grief that she couldn't say anything. And Rav Bachrach says something very beautiful. He says, "Olai lo yishiv Chana ki nichuvim shal hevel nichama." He was giving a comfort which was hevel. Hevel means like luft. It was nothing. It was baseless. Halo gam hu yodeh. He should know. I think he's saying that he does know. Elkanah knows that his love will not satisfy her need for children. He mentioned Rachel and Yaakov was another reference. I didn't read you it. What did Rachel say? I want children, otherwise I'm dead. And he's mentioned this to her. Nichumim shall have ela gamhei masifu tzara tzara. And instead of adding, trying to alleviate the situation, he just makes it worse. Tzar, more pain on pain. And these comments may have even given her more pain than that. And he says that she got to the point almost of giving up. And El Shari Tefillah, and she came to the deepest Tefillah, Mimamakim, Karaticha Hashem. The idea of Mimamakim, Mamakim has got a number of meanings. Mamakim, from the depths I call you Hashem, from the depths of absolute despair and almost to the point of giving up, she cries out to God. And, you know, imagine that Tefillah, it really, and it's quiet. So it's loud, it's shattering the spiritual world, and it's absolutely quiet. She's just mumbling. And of course, Eli, as we know later on, he thinks that she's drunk because she's swaying, she's shuckling, when in fact he thinks that she's probably just come in after having a couple of beers. Don't ask me why he thought she had some beer. Whatever it is, and it's very strange. It's all, you know, misunderstanding of Chana. So again, I don't feel too bad, and we spoke a bit about this last week, Elkanah on the one hand being this rather remarkable gentleman, communally wise, but in terms of his private relationships at home, not having so much success, and to want of a better word, you know, to being quite insensitive. I hesitate to use the word chauvinist, but once upon a time, probably 20 years ago, I might have used the word chauvinist as well. But I don't think so. I think it's chauvinism. I think it's just total lack of understanding. And it's a bit shocking, but on the other hand, as we said last week, the human condition is never far away from Tanakh. All right. Again, I wouldn't be allowed to say this in Brooklyn, I'm sure, but the reality is the sort of people we're dealing with are very human characters. They're very great people, but they're also human beings. And when we're dealing with an Elkanah, we're dealing with a man who is absolutely dedicated to God, but at the same time, he has issues. And he's got issues at home, and he's got issues with his wife, and, you know, it's reality. This the beauty of Jewish life, and particularly the books and the stories that we read, is that they are based in 2 feet, 1 foot like the ladder of Yaakov, right? It's feet on the ground and Rosh HaBashamayim. We're dealing with things which are in heaven, but nevertheless, the feet are on the ground. We're dealing with real situations. And that's what makes it so relevant and makes it so powerful. What I want to do now, basically, is try and understand Penina. And I'm going to give out the same sheet. There we go, Tzvi, if you can be the shamans. Thank you. This is the sheet part two that we started looking at last week. Last week we saw in section A the deal with Elkanah. This week we're going to see what is the deal with Penina. And it's taken again from another sefer of a very wonderful writer, as I mentioned last week, somebody called Yitzhak Levi. Zichron Levroch. Yitzhak Levi was a teacher in Bnei Brak, who passed away in 1991 in Israel. And he got up to chapter 15 of Shmuel Aleph. He wrote on Yeshua, he wrote on Shoftim, and got to Shmuel Aleph in the middle. And as I mentioned last week, he stopped, and that's hasn't been continued. The family was approached by various students to try and finish the project, and they refused. They said, we can never repeat in any way what our father did, and we're left kind of holding in the middle there of Shmuel Aleph. So at least we've got it for the first 15 chapters. I'm using this sefer also now. I'm teaching Yeshua, and it's breathtaking. He really, he's got this wonderful synthesis of midrashic and very, I would say, very, very real interpretation. Now listen to this. This is on section B on the left-hand side. How did Penina actually vex Chana? What did she do? I mentioned this last week. We see that there's like a continual vexation. This is on the left-hand side, the first line underlined. First two words are underlined. What did she do? Basically causing her grief after grief after grief. What did Penina say to Chana? Kanita lebincha gadol suda. Have you bought a suda, a cloth, some sort of clothing for your child? Or shemi chalukan, did you buy for the second one a shirt or whatever it is? In other words, she came back from a shopping spree and she showed all the baby clothes, and Chana's sitting there and crying her eyes out, as one could imagine. And the question is, what is possessing Penina to do this? You know, how can you torture the woman? This is absolute torture. And we have to understand, what is Penina's idea over here? What is she trying to do? And just to add a bit further to the concept here, what about the punishment? Once you understand or try to understand Penina's behavior, then the punishment that she gets also seems to be, as it were, out of proportion. Her behavior is extreme, and the punishment is even more extreme. Because what does it say? And this is taken from Midrash Shmuel, from the Midrashic literature, the second paragraph. V'lo matzimu she'ol d'chana chamisha. Chana only had 5 children in the end. Sh'ne'ma ki pakad Hashem et chana v'ata v'tel ishlosha banim u'shtei banot. 3 boys, 2 girls. And that's chapter 2 later on. Hokei said, how did it all come about? Reb Nechemiah says, Hayula Penina Sarabanim. We know that Penina, as we mentioned just now, had 10 children. 10 sons. Vaita Chana Yoledet Echa. Chana had her first child. Penina Kaveret Shnaim. Never. Penina started burying. She buried 2 of her children. Chana Yoledet Shnaim. She had another child. Penina Kaveret Abba. She's now buried 4 of her children. You know, you think at this point that Penina would get on her knees to Chana. She can see there's a connection. But it carried on. Shlosha Kaveret Shisha. 3 and she buried 6. She got to 4 children, Chana, and Penina's already lost 8 of her children. Never. What's going on here? Kivan she'ibra chamishi. Now Penina had her 5th pregnancy. At that point, Bata Chana v'shtakha raglev. Chana came down and literally prostrated herself in front of Penina, prostrated herself in front of Chana. Amar la vakasha mimeh, please. Hipaleli al shnayim v'yichyu. Pray for my last 2 children, they should live. Unbelievable story. Hit Palala Alem and Chana Davin, Vahayu Nikraim Hashma. And it turns out that those last 2 children of Penina are counted, in fact, as Chana's children. They're given the name as being the children of Chana. Rot Salama Shabemet Chana Yodel, like Chamisha. Really, she only had 5, Chana. Avashnei Bene, Anotarim, Al Penina Mikra Hashmam Shal Chana. The extra 2 sons, remember, she had. It says, in fact, that according to Pasuk later on, she had 7. She had 2 extra, which are counted as hers, but they're really Peninas. Right, that's the reference later on that she was. She started off Akara. She was barren, and she had 7 children. Reality was, she had 5, and she davened for Peninas' last 2 sons, and she managed to save their lives. So the question is, how do we understand Penina's behavior in the beginning? And how do we understand this terrible, terrible punishment in the end? This whole story is really quite amazing. And listen to this, there's 2 approaches which are very modern approaches. One of them is Tzir, and one of Reb Chaim Shmulevitz. Chaim Shmulevitz is a great Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva. Then the Tzir, I have to say, I'm very, very lucky to have done what I call the pilgrimage. The pilgrimage means that I've been to the grave of the Netziv. He's buried in Warsaw. And interestingly, just a sort of kind of aside, in Warsaw the tradition was not to bury men and women together. They buried the men and women separately. And the way that they buried them was that sometimes it was by profession, right? They have all the Yiddish poets buried in one place. Very interesting. So just to walk around the history in the Warsaw cemetery is amazing. And the other thing that they have is obviously family plots. And the Netziv is buried next to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the very famous Reb Chaim, the grandfather of the Rav, and they're buried literally side by side, and there's an oval there, there's a building over it, and there's a place to go and daven, and it was very moving to me. I have a picture at home of that particular cave, and it's something really to see. The Netziv was, just a very short mention of who he was, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva, the man who basically was credited, I suppose, with the Volozhin Yeshiva and the issues when it closed and how he stood his ground, and basically the Yeshiva did close, and there's a lot to say about that, but that's a different shiur completely. And the whole question really of what happened afterwards, that Berlin became Bar Ilan, right? I think you've all been on Bar Ilan Street, maybe in Israel once upon a time, and Remeir Bar Ilan, one of his sons, became very involved in the Mizrahi. And, you know, this is a man who literally, his children, grandchildren, beyond, have had tremendous influence, not only in the yeshiva world, but also in the religious development, certainly in the state of Israel. So, you know, this is kind of a major individual. And, of course, his commentaries are very, very, very popular and very well known. So he talks about Chana and Penina. And he talks about a concept here which is very difficult. The concept is known as an Aveira Lishma, all right? Now, a lot of people like to dream that this might happen one day, that you might actually find that you can do an Aveira, a sin, for the sake of God. But the question is, what does that mean? How can you do such a thing? And the answer, the Gemara actually talks about it. And the Gemara makes an amazing statement. The Gemara says that a sin for the sake of God can be greater, Gedolah is greater than a mitzvah which is not for the sake of God. So you'll say to me, whoa, that's an amazing statement. Because it seems to be encouraging us to do Aveiras for the sake of God. You know, so I can stand on the street on Shabbos and throw stones at cars and say, Aveira l'shem shamayim, and, you know, unfortunately some people do think that. The answer is no. It doesn't work like that. An Aveira for the sake of God is an extreme situation where in history certain individuals did things for the sake of the Jewish people. the obvious example coming up to Purim and Esther. And Esther's a very complicated character to actually deal with, because although everybody likes to dress up their kids like Esther, the reality is if we actually follow through on what happened to Esther after the Purim story, I don't know whether we're so keen to share that information with the young ones. The problem is she stays with Ahasuerus. And not only does she stay with him, she has a child with him. The child is known as Darius, and he becomes one of the key players later on in the building of the Second Temple. So there is an issue here, what happens after this Purim story. Esther is a very interesting and very challenging, the Gemara already talks about it, Gemara Sanhedrin, even her relationship with Ahasuerus at the beginning, and basically the answer, one of the suggestions is that she's doing an Aveira Lishma. She's doing a sin, but she's doing it for the sake of God, in order to save the Jewish people. We learned about Yael a few months ago, and the same thing. Yael enticed Sisera into her tent, and according to Chazal, she seduced him, and then there's a whole story there. And the reality was, again, she's doing something which seemingly goes against the values, Jewish values of modesty and tzniut and everything else. And the answer is, Aveira Lishma. For the sake of the Jewish people, you are allowed to do this under very extreme circumstances to save Am Yisrael. And there were terrible cases during the Second World War. Rav Oshri, who was the rabbi in the Lower East Side, passed away not so long ago. He was a remarkable gentleman who, in Kovna, he was the Rav in Kovna before he was liberated after the war. And this amazing book of response of the Holocaust. And he's asked all these incredible questions. And again, people were asking him to do things which essentially were avirot lishma. Right? They were sins, but they were the sake of God. They were trying to save their lives. And his attitude, seemingly whatever you could do to save your life, had to be done if it would have any chance at all. That is a book that you have to read. It's a Tisha B'Av book. It's not a book you read during the year. But on Tisha B'Av, it really is an unbelievable experience to read that book. And again, these are, as I said, these are rare situations. Penina, and the suggestion of Netziv is that she, in this situation, considered it also Aveira Lishma. To do what she did to vex Chana was clearly Aveira, was clearly wrong, but it was the Shem Hashem, it was for the sake of God. She was hoping that by inspiring Chana to daven more, even though she was doing it in such a negative way, holding up the diapers and the you name it, and showing Chana, why don't you buy this stuff, and all these sort of cruel things that she was saying, she was trying to inspire Chana to daven even more than she had done before. The problem is, says the Netziv, she wasn't allowed to do it that way. She should have found another way to get Chana to become more inspired to pray. And the suggestion of the Netziv is that as much as Penina was trying to incorporate this idea of Aveira Lishma and to do it for the sake of God, but it was still an Aveira. And in the end, she is punished because she miscalculated on what she was doing in terms of the way that she was upsetting Chana, the as you say in the language of the Perek, Pirkei Avot, the hefsir was greater than the sechar. The loss was greater than the reward. And this is a very interesting suggestion, but I think it kind of explains a bit of what's going on here. Yeah.
Why don't we see that in the Pasha Pshat? The Pasha Pshat is that she had the 10 children.
Yeah.
And she's the Tzara.
Yeah.
She's saying, look, I'm much more fortunate than you are. Why don't we see that in the Pasha Pshat?
Meaning what?
That she vexed her L'shem Shamayim, that she was trying
Well, again, we That's the problem, that we try to see it in the Parsha Pshat, but it bothers us, the way she behaved. In other words, what I'm trying to suggest is, yeah, it's in the Pshat, but we need to find a rationale for her to even come out with these words. All right, we're bothered by Elkanah. He seems to be totally insensitive, almost totally insensitive, let's put it that way. And now we've got Penina being insensitive, right? So let's try at least and find some justification for Penina to be insensitive. And that's the problem. I agree. It's in the verse, but the insensitivity is something which bothers us terribly. So what I'm trying to suggest is that there is a logic to this, but it was a miscalculated logic. That's what the Netziv tries to suggest. Rechash Melevi says something kind of similar to that, because his feeling is that we're talking about Penina as a tzedekus. Penina is a very righteous lady, so how could she behave like this? And again, he basically says the idea was that although her intentions were honorable for the sake of heaven, again, she miscalculated the whole thing. He doesn't use the language of Aveira Lishma, but again, in his own way, it's very much on the lines of the Netziv. I'll just read the first paragraph here of the Netziv. You'll see what he's going at here. Eina is, this is taken from his commentary, Hamek Davar, at the end of Pasha Shalah. Okay, and again, it's worth looking up maybe the whole commentary there, but this is a little snippet of what he says. He says, "Ein le'ish latur achar mitzvot chadashot." He says, don't go looking for new mitzvahs. All right, we've got plenty of mitzvahs to do. Don't start looking for new ones. V'lasot aveira lishma chavishon, because it'll turn out you may end up doing an aveira for the sake of God. God forbid. The alpha gav the ita benozi. Even though the Gemara says, and Gemara knows it, gedola aveira lishma mitzvah shelo lishma. A sin for the sake of God is can be great as a mitzvah which is not for the sake of God, which seems to give it a bit of a heksher. Mikol makom ze einu ele sheba sha'al yado. This is talking when it has to be done for a specific, in a specific situation, a crisis. Shemuchrach la'asot aveira l'shem shamayim. You have to do it for the sake of heaven, and it has to be done. Kahal de Tamar v'Yehuda, a story in the Torah of Tamar and Yehuda. Shelo hayala etzah acheret. She had to seduce him in the way that she did, because she knew that out of this relationship would come the beginnings of the Mashiach. Right? That's a whole explanation about Yehuda and Tamar for another time. O maaseh di Ya'el, or the story of Ya'el, which we mentioned already, and we've actually. There's a shir about that on the web, which you can listen to. Avalaham sin av sholakach, but to do this, as it were, to invent this from your own initiative, lasot avera l'shem shamayim, to do an avera for the sake of God, ein ze haderech hayashar shevo l'adam. This, the Perek uses that expression, it's not the way that a person should choose. He sees it as going against that pasuk in the third paragraph of the Shema. Kamosha Bianu, as he explains over there, and Ayn Sham Barichot, you have to look in the Hamek Dova and see what he says. So again, Penina was doing something which, with all good intentions, as they say, the road. What's the expression? The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And this is what happened to Penina, Nebuch. And Nebuch, what a punishment. I just want to read to you what Rechayim Shmulevitz says. Rechayim Shmulevitz was the very outstanding Rosh Yeshiva in the Mir Yeshiva, went to Shanghai and then came to Eretz Yisrael, and I think passed away in the late 70s or early 80s, I don't remember now. Again, somebody very major influence in that particular world. And he writes the following. He says, "Kvar bi'anu," just dropping to the next paragraph. The beveirot shebein adam lechaver. We explain in sins between man and man. Lo mo'ila kavanatova. You can say I had a good intention, but you're still doing something wrong. Va'afilo asav nitkaven l'shem shemayim. I did it for the sake of God. Ukomar shematzina bepenina. And he talks about Penina. She'omer chazal. The rabbi say ki l'shem shemayim nitkaven. She did it for the sake of God. What a terrible punishment. Shemetu banea, her children died, kakatuva rabat banim umlala. She had so many children that she became umlal, she became so unfortunate. This is the line I want you to remember. Penina was a tzadekis, there's no discussion about that. So you have to understand that what she was doing must have given herself terrible grief. To have to vex the other woman in such a way, for Penina must have been going against her nature, going against everything she really stood for. And I think this is getting to the heart of the issue. You know, I remember learning this in school or hearing the story, and it was always presented as one was more jealous than the other, and it was an act of jealousy, and you know, all this sort of negative stuff. The fact is, we're talking about whatever the plural of tzadekis is, tzadekiyot, I'm not sure, tzadekisness, right? And the reality is that, you know, we can't just brush it off and say, well, this one was jealous of that one, and she behaved in such a way because she had children, the other one didn't, and she felt superior. No, it doesn't work. He says, Penina was absolutely with an intention, l'shem shamayim. She was a righteous lady, but of course the problem was, it was still an aveira ben on the chaver. She was doing something bad, literally between herself and Chana, and it was, in the end, it worked against her. Ubavadai, just to continue, haya kashela ma'od l'tzayit Chana, must have been very difficult to cause Chana so much grief. She did it all for the sake of bringing Chana to more prayer. Vayaderech mesir nefesh mamash mitzad penir. It was a mesiris nefesh here. There's a tremendous effort which is going on above and beyond on the sake of Penina. Or b'chol zot, and Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, you know what? With all of the cheshbon and all of the argument and everything that we've learned, ma'anera oinsha, how terrible her punishment. It's frightening. V'kol kach lama, so he says, why? Ki apogea b'chaver, this comes to the Musa, I apologize. I don't usually like telling Musa, but in this case I can't avoid it. He says, kol apogea b'chaver, when you damage your friend, in whatever way it is, you machshavotav asheyu, whatever thoughts you have, which you think are going to be so positive, harer k'machnis yado l'tavtana eish, you're putting your hand in the flame, in the fire. Ve'ein zeh b'torat onish gereda, this is not just a punishment, etc. And he talks about this in his sichot. Ve'ein ha'kavanah, after the brackets, ve'ein ha'kavanah tova yechola l'shanot b'zeh mumah. At the end of the day, you put your hand in the fire, you're going to get burned. Whether you intend well or not, it doesn't matter. You're going to burn yourself. Hasakana ba'aveirash ben adchaver. The danger when you have a sin between man and man, he metziut tivit. Wow, it's a natural situation. Mamesh kishem sha'esh sarefe b'derech ha'teva. Just as fire burns in a natural way. That's a scary statement. As you see, Sichas Musa. This is one of the svarim that they brought out Rav Chaim's talks, etc., that he gave in the 70s, Tavshin Lamed Aleph, 1971. Just want to read the bottom thing here. Cheshbonah shel Penina mutaha. So in the end of the day, we have to say Penina's calculation here was mistaken. Ein zo adarech eshara. This is not the straight path. Sha'adam yamsi la'atzmo mitzvot chadashot. You start inventing mitzvahs. V'la'asod avera l'shem shemayim, to do a sin for the sake of God. K'she'ein echrach l'kach, if there's no need. U'bifrat, especially here, k'ashe avera shi ben adal chavero. The sin is a sin between her and Chana. Sheba al afa kavanot atavot biyote. With all the best intentions, it's still an avera. You are absolutely endangering yourself, like putting your hand into a flame. Kama gadola ita pina. And of course, the argument is, how great was Penina? This is a very difficult thing to say. But the fact that she had such an incredible punishment, shows her greatness and not her weakness. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu's punishment gives us an indication of how great he was. Not how weak he was, how great that on such a sin, whatever the sin was, the reality was that he lost the chance to go to Eretz Yisrael. And, you know, we learn from that the greatness of the person, not the weakness of the person. And the same thing he's suggesting here with Penina, her punishment, as it were, is an indication of her righteousness. It's very hard. You know, with all of this explanation, with all of the allowances that we're trying to read into this, it's an incredibly difficult story to understand, but it's a very human story. In the end of the day, Penina wants Chana to have children, and she knows the only way to go about it here, there's no doctors to go and see, there's no fertility clinics in those days, so you can't go that route. So you've got to go the route of Tefillah. That's what you've left, you know, that's your last chance. And Penina wants to facilitate it, but she's facilitating it in such a negative way. It's just causing not only grief to Chana, but in the end, terrible, terrible repercussions for Penina as well. There's a bit of Musa in that. I don't want to elaborate on that too much, but I think Hamevi and Yovin, I'm sure everyone will take the message as one has heard it. Wow. So I don't know what the answer is. I don't know if anyone's got a better suggestion than this to try and understand Penina's behavior here. I really don't know. Penina and the Peninim. Penina is the idea of a jewel. All right, she's a special lady, Penina. Chana is the idea of grace, you know, chen, bechent. So, you know, we're talking about women who have names who are very, very sort of great characteristics and great role models, and therefore, you know, to try and just push this all into sort of a, you know, like a squabble between two women over the husband or over whatever, it's not that. It's much deeper than that. So I think maybe this gives us a bit of an insight, but, you know, is this really the final word on this particular topic? I really don't know. I'm sort of leaving you to sort of, you know, fathom that one out. I'm not quite sure. All right, so that's covered, I hope, a bit of that particular problem. All right, we'll go a bit further. We're up to Pasuk Yud, and we'll just see what happens at this point in time. And we'll begin talking a bit about the Neder, because as I said before, this is again a very challenging subject. I just want to keep an eye on the clock. V'hi morat nefesh. So we know that she was very bitter. Chana, Pasuk Yud, verse 10. V'titpalel al Hashem, v'bachot tivkeh, she davened al Hashem, whatever that means, above, but normally translated to God. All right, we may come to an understanding of that. V'bachot tivkeh, and she continued crying. She was weeping. V'tidor neder v'tomar. Now here comes a pasuk which is again very challenging. She made a neder, and she said, "Hashem Tzavaot, the Lord of hosts, And there's a whole Rashi over here, which I just refer you to, which is a reference to the fact that she's making a statement to God, that God can produce the heaven and the earth, so why can't you help me to have a child? You know, she's using every kind of argument towards Hashem that she can possibly use. And you'll have a look at the Rashi there, and you'll see for yourself. But he says, it goes on, the Pasuk says, she says, if you will look and see the poverty of your maidservant, right? Uzachartani, you will remember me, velo tishkachet amatecha, you won't forget your servant, venatata la matcha zera nashim, and you will give to your servant the seed of man, otherwise I will have a child. Unatativ lashem kol yumei chaya. And we normally translate this, I will give him to Hashem kol yumei chaya for all the days of his life. And something will not go upon his head. What does the word morah mean? Okay, morah is, I mean, we're in a room, it's probably, the word morah is all around the wall here. Morah, normally, you know, modern Hebrew is a teacher, all right, of the female persuasion. Morah just reminds me very briefly, I have to just share this, if some of you may not know this. I've mentioned this evening, I mentioned Bachrach, and I mentioned Rav Levi. I can't not mention the Chamalivis, right, the third of maybe a number of great Bible teachers I was merited to have the zchut to actually get to know very well. And Chama was a remarkable woman in so many ways. And again, I'm a bit frustrated because a lot of her novi shiurim had not been written down. She wrote them down. She had pages for everything, but they haven't been printed. And the word morah reminds me of Nechama in a very special way, and some of you may know this. As she left, the story is basically that she married very late in her life, and they didn't have children. I think her husband was blind, and she read to him. That's how she got very involved in learning, because she was reading to him Gemaras and Midrash and everything. She knew it all. Wow. She once commented in a shir, I remember hearing her say, that she'd read every commentary on Rashi. Right? Not Rashi, every Rashi, every commentary on Rashi. So I ask you, how many commentaries are there on Rashi? Right? Give me a number, and then double it. All right? How many commentaries on Rashi?
10.
10, right? She said 200. 200 commentaries on Rashi. What she called super commentaries. And they're super in sort of different ways. 200 commentaries? Unbelievable. And she came out with a statement, and she's read every one of them. All right, you know, you blow your mind when you hear that. Why do I mention her with Morah? Because she left a will at the end where she said on her grave, on her tombstone, she only wants one word, and the word is Morah, teacher. And I've got to, again, I have to bring this picture along. I must show it to you. I was in Israel maybe, when was it, 2000 and whatever, 2002, 2003, and I persuaded my wife's uncle to go and pay it as again another pilgrimage to the grave of the Chamalivitz, and she's buried in the Har Menuchot, very near the entrance. When you go in, if you ask somebody, they'll tell you where she is, and you see the stone, and it's just breathtaking, because you know you could have written a whole Megillah there. You know, if you look at most of the stones there with all the various rabbis and rebbetzins or whatever, you know, this and that, you know, it goes to a whole list in Hebrew. One word, Morah, and it says it all. She had no children, but she had thousands of children, thousands of students. And on her tombstone, that's the word, Morah, teacher, nothing else. And, you know, I thought to myself, I talk about this a lot, because I'm just wondering, if you spend your whole life, and don't get me wrong, it's not a bad thing to be an accountant or a lawyer, but I don't know if any of us would want to put, you know, accountant on your tombstone as the one word of a memorial to what you did in your life. You probably want to mention other things as well. And as far as she's concerned, that was it, Morah. And it really is there, you know, the stone is there, and it's just one word on the stone, obviously with her name and the date and the word Morah. It's very powerful. It's really made me cry when I went there. It was really something special. I expected her to sit up, actually, at that point and sort of wave and say, you know, get back to the safer, get back to learning, because that's what she was. She was a very, very interesting lady. That's Morah. So Morah is the idea, again, of two possible translations here. Morah, the idea of instruction, but more in the sense of yira, in the sense of fear. And another interpretation over here of Morah is the idea of literally, Morah li'ala rosho, is reference to something completely different. The idea that we know that Shmuel, along with Shimshon and various other individuals, became what is called Nazirin, a Nazir. And Morah li'ala rosho means that he will never ever shave his hair. All right, he will be, for want of a better word, he'll look like the nowadays, the what we used to call the hippo, don't they call him today. And this is how Shmuel will look his whole life, a Nazir. Yes?
How does that
Morad, Morad, the idea of Morad means a razor. Alright, so a razor will never come upon his head. So refers to a nozzle. Now why the razor is called Morad, that's a twist of Hebrew. And I suspect Rabbi Hirsch and various other Hebraists, you know, who wrote about this stuff will probably give you the etymology or whatever the word is of that particular word. I suppose razor being sharp, and fear is something which is sharp, you know, in the sense of sharp not being afraid of God, like something which should sort of like the sword hanging over your head. I'm not quite sure. I don't want to go too far into that relationship. But there's an interesting thing over here. The question really is, in terms of understanding what this pasuk is really saying. And as I said at the beginning of the evening, that many people learn this pasuk and say, oh, she obviously made a condition. And the condition was that she's making a vow that if she has a child, that child will be given to God and will become a nozer and will work in the Mishkan. That's going to be the deal. All right? And that's how normally people understand it. I just want to point you to Rashi over here. All right? Unatativ Lashem. The Rashi is on Pasuk, where are we? Yud Aleph, verse 11. And the Rashi is like halfway through the Pasuk. Unatativ Lashem, we translated that she's making a vow, Unatativ Lashem, that I will give him to God. All right? Now look at Rashi here, because Rashi doesn't translate it like that. Unatativ Lashem, Rashi says, Sheyehe ra'ui letito lashem, that he should be fitting, he should be ra'ui, he should be someone of the right caliber to be given to Hashem. So in other words, Rashi is seeing the tativ lashem not as an act of giving, but as a tefillah to God that I hope he would be fit to be given to God. Now Rashi is opening up a whole different shot in this whole idea. Rashi is not, as it were, going along with the normal idea that she is offering him to God, as we know that, you know, she promises to bring him to the temple, etc. But Rashi is actually saying, I hope that he will be fit to be brought to the Mishkan. It could be that Rashi is saying that what we always understood as the promise of Chana is not about actually dedicating her son to the Mishkan, but as it were, it's kind of a hope that he will be hopefully good enough that he would be able to go into that particular position. Yeah.
Every model of neder, like by Yisrael Yaakov, neder Lamar,
yeah.
And Israel was no der neder. If you do this, Hashem, I will do this.
Yeah.
Every model we have of neder is, I'll do something.
So if it's not promising to bring him to the Mishkan, what is he doing? And that's going to be the big challenge over here. What is her neder? If it's not actually doing what I always thought it was, which was to bring him to the Mishkan, then what is she actually promising? All right? And there's going to be an answer for that as well. But what I'm trying to show you is that with a bit of analysis over here, the whole story changes. It's not the classic story of the woman promising her the child that will be born to her will be offered, as it were, will be brought to the Mishkan. It could very well be that her promise was something completely different. And in the course of what she said, she is saying to God, I hope that the child you will give me will be fitting enough to be able to work in the Mishkan, to be able to give him to God. But not necessarily promising to do so, all right, in the way that we've normally understood it. And it's very interesting. As I said at the beginning, there is, you know, the basic question is even more basic than that. As we said right at the beginning, that if he's a Levi, right, then what are you promising over here? Something which in essence he's going to do anyway. He's going to work in the Mishkan. So if you're promising to bring him to the Mishkan, what exactly is she doing? And it's even more complicated than that, because there is a golden rule, which is right throughout Gemara, is that you can't promise something on a future. All right, I know that in the stock market they work like that, but reality is, you know, that you don't promise on something which doesn't yet exist. All right, and the idea of Dovah Shelo Bala Olam. In the end of the day, Shmuel is Dovah Shelo Bala Olam. He hasn't yet been born. So what is she doing making commitments to bring him to the Mishkan in a future situation when he's not yet around? You can't, you know, this is something which is very challenging. And there is actually an argument between the Mephoshim as to whether you can do this. Yeah.
If a lady has a blemish, are they still allowed to serve in the...
They probably would. They wouldn't do the front line stuff, like the current.
Oh, okay.
All right, you know, they would, nowadays you'd say they work in the office. Yeah, I understand, but it's maybe not going in that direction. Maybe we're looking at something which is in fact very different to the way that we've normally understood this, right? I mean, in essence, the vow of Chana is a very challenging prospect, right? According to, certainly halachically becomes very challenging, and I would say ethically and morally it also will become challenging as well. And it could very well be that what we've always understood the vow to be is not really what it is. All right, and that, as I teach this stuff, I always like the reaction of the audience. Usually at Stern, I teach at the Stern College, and the girls usually sit there and the mouths drop because, you know, I know this story. You know, this is one of the stories that everybody knows. And I'm trying to show that it's not so straightforward. It really is not so straightforward. Kind of interesting and challenging. We've got a few minutes. I just want to read, I will distribute the sheet next week. I just want to read a couple of points to get you thinking about next what we're going to be dealing next week. Listen to this. It's three questions, essentially, that we're going to deal with. Number one, and I'll just read it from the page here, but Mr. Shem, next week I'll distribute it. I'm not going to give it out now. I'll give it out, please God, next time. Again, Reb Levi does this, but a lot of the Mephoreshim ask the same question. He's not yet born. How can she make a promise about something which is not yet born? Is not in her control, as it were. And in such a case, if something is it's not yet coming to creation, not yet coming to being, how can you make a promise, a commitment on something which is not yet, as it were, in existence? So if we learn that she's actually making a vow on her future son, halachically there is a very big question over here. It's a problem. And the Radak already deals with this and tries and remains in a very great quandary about the whole thing, all right? Because the question is even more complicated because she's not only committing to bring him to the Mikdash, but she's seemingly committing him to be a Nozer as well. And again, he's not yet born. All right, we know with Shimshon that there was a Malach, and we know that the story of the angel, and Shimshon became a Nazarite. But that's a special case. Here, there doesn't seem to be Malachim flying around telling Chana that your son has to be a Nozer. All right, we've not got the same situation over here as we had with Shimshon. Question number two, which is also interesting, is that he's a Levi anyway. So what is she promising to bring him as a Levi to the Mishkan? He's going to go anyway. So you could always say, as the Radak says, that she's going to bring him early. Normally he would only have to go when he's 25 years old. She's going to bring him before the age of 25. You know, at the end of the day, if he's going to be there, then okay, so he's going a bit early. But is this really such a great thing that she's doing when he's a Levi anyway? His father, Elkanah, we already established last week, is a Levi. So what is the whole big deal over here? And not only that, this is so interesting. We translated Moralo Yala Rosho, the first translation, he will never be afraid. Fear will never come upon him, Shmuel. Alright? Here's a big test for you. Look at chapter 16 of Shmuel Aleph. And you're almost up to that. Look at Shmuel Aleph, chapter 16. And if you just turn to that very quickly, and I'll just leave you with this bomba kasha, and this is a major question. Shmuel, chapter 16, after Shaul has lost the kingship, Shmuel has been told by God he's got to go and anoint a new king. Look at what Shmuel says over here. Chapter 16, verse 1. Vayomer Hashem Shmuel, ad matay ata mitabel al Shaul, stop mourning for Shaul. In other words, get on with it. Do something. Ani mastir mimlach Yisrael, he's basically now rejected. In other words, one of the sons of Yishai will be a king. Listen to this. This is Moral Yala Rosho. He's going to be a man fearless, right? This is Shmuel. How can I go? Shaul will hear about it and he'll kill me. Wait a second. I just translated Moral Yala Rosho. He's never going to be afraid. And here he's basically saying to God, right? I can't go. Shaul will hear that I'm going to anoint a new king, and he's going to be very angry, and there's a potential for Shaul. I know he's in a state of depression. He might kill me. So how can you say Morale Yala Rosho means that he'll never be afraid, according to the first interpretation, when in fact we see from the story later on, he was very afraid. And you know what happened in that story, and that's going to be a whole parsha by itself, sometime in 2009, I suspect, somewhere along that line. Vayom Hashem, so Hashem says to him, maybe 2008, Hashem said to him, you know what, we're going to make a pretext. You're going to say to Shaul that you're going to do a korban. It's not really true, and this is the whole problem. Remember, again, I had a share from the Chamalibits on this, because seemingly Hashem is telling him not to be absolutely honest in what he's saying to the crowd when he goes to anoint David. So, you know, is Hashem allowing people to, let's use the words, be economical with the truth? That's a whole debate by itself, and that's a very, very interesting topic, but for another time. It's very... I'm just teaching that now, actually, in Stern, and we've had a lot of interesting reaction on that one. And this is the whole story at the beginning of chapter 16. Whatever you say, if you just go back now to chapter 1, verse 11, when we read the words, when Chana says, Morale Yale Rosho, which we translated initially that nobody is going to, as it were, cause him any fear. It's going to be above him, as it were, to make him afraid. That doesn't work, because we know in reality he was afraid. In which case, what is going on with this particular phrase? What's this pasuk really mean? So this vow of Chana is incredibly difficult, is unbelievably difficult. And what we're actually going to suggest, that there is a machloket here between Rashi, and we're going to develop the Rashi, please God, next week, and also the Rambam, Maimonides, who basically takes a completely different tack. And between the two of them, we're going to come to an understanding of the neder, which is very, very unique. Very different, I would argue, from anything that maybe you've understood it, in any way you've understood it till now. And I hope gives you a sort of greater awareness, and I would argue, greater appreciation of who Chana really is. She is a very special lady. She's beyond special. This is the woman that we use as the prototype for Davening Shemoneh Esrei, right? So she's got to be something unique, and she's more than unique. And then you put these two together, Elkanah, we learned last week, Chana, what we're beginning to talk about now, and you begin to realize that Shmuel was not just stum, as they say. Shmuel was really something very, very above and beyond in so many ways. So Mitzvah Shem to be continued. I think we'll hold it here because we're going to dump tomorrow. Thank you, everybody. Have a good evening.
So, when it was successful.
Sorry?
It was really great.